in and for the 7th Judicial Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case this morning is United States versus Simmons. Mr. Stevens.
Yes, Your Honor. Julian Simmons was released after serving an 11-year sentence in the custody of the Bureau of Prisons. He was released not to a Bureau of Prisons halfway house, but to a period of supervised release, which included a voluntary agreement to reside for the first 6 months in a halfway house facility. Mr. Simmons had been unable to come up with any release plan other than a release to a homeless shelter, and the probation office and the Bureau of Prisons found that to be unacceptable. So, with Mr. Simmons' permission and approval, they placed him in a halfway house. I think it's important to note that he was not placed in a halfway house for any disciplinary action or any punitive action or matters having to do with any write-ups in prison or the nature of his prior convictions. In fact, the agreement for his release provided that if he was able to find a suitable residence, he would be terminated from the requirement that he reside in a halfway house. So clearly, as Mr. Montgomery, the probation officer, said, this was to assist him in a transition from an 11-year prison sentence into residing in the community. It was not intended to in any way be punitive or disciplinary. Mr. Simmons was required to comply with the conditions of the halfway house and the rules and regulations there. He did not, and the probation office filed a petition for his revocation. Although a number of matters were alleged, the government elected to pursue only two at the hearing, one that he made sexual proposals to female inmates, and the second that he was disruptive and interfering with the orderly running of the facility by hanging around the control desk area, an area that inmates were prohibited from hanging around and interfering with the operations there. The court made no findings whatsoever on the issue of whether he made any sexual proposals to any female inmates, and only made findings on the fact that he had disruptive conduct. Now, the issue that I bring to this court is whether, in light of the testimony that was presented, the sentence that Mr. Simmons received was reasonable. And in making that assessment, did the court consider the factors set out in 18 United States Code Section 3553?
What's the difference between reasonable and plainly? Or plainly unreasonable?
I think that's a difficult question. I don't have any case law to cite to the court on that issue.
I think it's pretty much the same.
I would consider them pretty much the same, but a reasonable sentence, simply by terms of the statute and the sentencing guidelines, requires that a court consider the factors in 3553, which includes not only the sentencing guidelines, but the nature and circumstances of the offense, the characteristics of the defendant, the issues of deterrence, the issues of sentences that non-disparity of sentences. There are a number of factors that are set out in 3553. This court hasn't required a court to go down and do a checklist of each of those items, but what this court has required is that the sentencing court plainly indicate on the record that these factors were considered.
Judge Miller did say, take note of his apparently extensive criminal record, didn't he?
What Judge Miller said was that, particularly in light of Mr. Simmons' history from other institutions, he felt that this was a more serious offense. And certainly in computing the sentencing guidelines, he took into account the prior criminal history. So there were factors that were considered. But Let's take the bell curve of sentences that a court might impose for a grade C violation and look at them in the way the Sentencing Commission might. In that bell curve, we have what the Sentencing Commission has talked about, or what the courts have talked about, as the heartland of those sentences. Let's say the middle 60% of the cases fall in that heartland, leaving 20% on either side. What Judge Miller told us was there's certainly more serious grade C violations. He doesn't put Mr. Simmons all the way at the end of that bell curve.
But then doesn't he say that he was very frustrated with Simmons' performance on supervised release, and he found that the maximum term of imprisonment with no additional supervised release to be appropriate simply because there doesn't seem to be much else we can do? Doesn't that imply that he's looked at the range of those options?
Well, in looking at that, we have to look at what a reasonable sentence is, and the Sentencing Commission certainly has set some parameters for us. They've set a 6 to 12 month sentencing range for those that fall in the middle of those group of sentences. Now, pre-Booker, certainly, district courts had a great deal more latitude in supervised release violations than they did in district court cases. The guidelines were much more advisory at that point in time than they were in criminal cases. But we still need to look at the fact that Mr. Simmons would have had to go out and commit a felony for the Sentencing Commission, who had made a study of sentences, to say that he should receive a 24-month sentence. It's not just a grade C violation, which Judge Miller characterized as not the most serious of grade C violations. It's not a grade B violation where it would be a misdemeanor, or at least a misdemeanor would be a grade C violation, but it would have to be a grade B violation constituting a felony before you get up into an area where the court would consider, or the Sentencing Commission would consider, this to be serious enough for a maximum term of 24 months to be imposed. What we have is someone who didn't react well to the structure and discipline of a halfway house. Mr. Simmons never had an opportunity to demonstrate whether he would be able to function in a less structured environment out in the community. Certainly an option that would allow him to demonstrate that after a period of incarceration, punishing him for the behavior exhibited at the halfway house would have deterrent effect, it would have punitive effect, it would have would promote the respect for the laws, all of the factors that are included in 3553.
But this is a little different, because when you look at the, while he was serving his sentence on interstate travel, he was convicted later for assaulting a prison staff member with a deadly weapon. So, I mean, this is kind of a unique criminal history, isn't it? Given that these other violations occurred when he was in a halfway house, and so the court, trying to put all that in context, realizes that there's some real problems.
Well, his initial sentence was a nonviolent offense.
Right.
His second conviction, for which he was incarcerated federally, at least,
right,
was a violent offense. Certainly, I have to concede.
And it was assaulting a prison official, a staff member, with a deadly weapon. So, I mean, when you talk about something lesser, I just wonder what you envision. He would just be on straight supervised.
Well, certainly a period of incarceration is appropriate both under the sentencing guidelines and under the facts of this case. Judge Miller found this to be more serious than the average grade C violation. A 12-month sentence which fell within the guideline range would have been a reasonable sentence, followed by a further period of supervision to see whether he can adjust, because he didn't commit a violent act. All he did was hang around the desk where he wasn't supposed to be, insisting that he wanted a hat and coat, insisting that he wanted staff attention, insisting that he wanted to smoke. He was admittedly difficult in the halfway house, but his behavior that Judge Miller found didn't constitute in any respect any violent behavior. For those reasons, I would ask this court to remand this case to Judge Miller with instructions that he consider the factors under 3553 and impose a sentence that is a reasonable sentence.
Thank you, Mr. Stevens. Mr. Hayes?
May it please the Court, Kenneth Hayes on behalf of the United States. What we have here, Your Honors, is a person who was initially convicted of a 60-month narcotics offense by Judge Miller. While serving that sentence, assaulted a federal officer and received an additional 84-month sentence. While at the Packed Bradley Center was disruptive and a management problem, acquired 30 incident reports while he was incarcerated, and had been to three different institutions, all with increasing security, resulting in an administrative maximum sentence.
What do you think the difference is between a sentence that is reasonable and a sentence that is not plainly unreasonable?
Fortunately, Your Honor, I had the opportunity to hear that question when Your Honor asked it of Mr. Stevens. First of all, I think that plainly unreasonable is a little different from reasonable in the sense that I think he has to convince this court that it was plainly unreasonable rather than a de novo kind of is it reasonable, isn't it? But more importantly, the word plainly, I think, it has to be given some meaning. I mean, this court didn't say plainly unreasonable without meaning to say plainly. To me, plainly would imply something like obvious at first blush, clear, easily observable. I don't have any, like Mr. Stevens, I don't have any case law to offer on that.
But do you think the standard of review has to be different now after Booker and reviewing supervised release?
No, I don't think that Booker affects this situation because this situation, the court had, its discretion was not limited, whereas before Booker, a guideline sentence was. So
no, I don't think Booker affects this. I think our same standard of review, which we've always applied in reviewing supervised release revocation issues, that standard being whether it was plainly unreasonable, should apply to post-Booker analysis.
Yes. Okay. That's how I see it. That's not an issue that we've briefed, and I haven't run that comment by the Department of Justice, obviously, Your Honor, but that's how I see it at first blush. Yes, sir. This court, as in, for instance, the Hale case, has made it clear that in revocation of supervised release situations, the sentencing court is not required to recite the precise words of Section 3553, the sentencing statute, but is only required to offer comments that makes it clear that the sentencing court considered those factors. Judge Miller clearly evaluated the sentencing ranges and the policy statements that were confronting him as required by Section 3553A4 and A5. He considered Mr. Simmons' history as required by 3553A1. The district court considered the nature and circumstances of the violation, including the seriousness of the offense, and of course quite appropriately found that this was not a comparatively major violation. But what Judge Miller did is to look at the rest of the statute, consider all of the history, and concluded that although the violation was comparatively small, his history, the background, etc., made it clear that a much longer sentence was appropriate. Judge Miller specifically commented about the policy statements and the guidelines in 7B1.4. He talked about the remarkable, he said Mr. Simmons had a pretty remarkable history of institutional conduct problems and went on to elaborate. He talked about how Mr. Simmons had said to Mr. Simmons, you certainly seem to be a different person than you were in 1983. So even he remembered back, he thought back to what Mr. Simmons was like when he first appeared in front of him, recognized that he was a different person then. That's even more probative of Mr. Simmons than merely looking at his history, I think. The judge considered the nature of the transgressions. He considered the need to deter and protect the public. Didn't use those phrases, certainly. But he talked about how not even a month into the supervised release term he was having problems. He talked about the ongoing nature of Mr. Simmons' misconduct, and I think that goes to the question of the need to deter future crime and to protect the public as required in 3553A2D. Given all of those circumstances, given the history, given the fact that the judge talked extensively and explained over about 5 or 6 pages his reasoning for selecting this sentence, I don't believe it can be said that the sentence was plainly unreasonable. I would ask this court to affirm the district court, and I would waive any further argument at this time unless the court has questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hayes.
Thank you.
How much time, Mr. Stevens?
The only thing I would add, Your Honors, is that in this post-Booker world, the playing field's been leveled for district judges. Prior to Booker, district judges had a limited ability to depart from sentencing guidelines in criminal cases and a much wider discretion in supervised release cases. Today, I would submit that Booker tells us that district judges have a wide latitude of authority, but they are still subject to guidelines. What I'm asking this court to do is say that in both criminal cases and supervised release revocations or probation violation revocations, judges should give great deference to the sentencing guidelines. Thank you,
Mr. Stevens. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. Move to case number 2 this morning.